Get your shit together, Cassidy.
I wish I had any say in it.
No, I think you do. It's mind over matter.
Cool. No, it's medicine over money. Yes.
That's fair.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from California, you are Cassidy Robinson.
Been watching that show by W. Kamau Bell, The United Shades of America.
I don't know what you're talking about. Go on.
W. Kamau Bell is a stand-up comedian from San Francisco. He's this big, tall, black guy with a frizzy afro who talks a lot about social justice and identity politics in a funny and inclusive way. And he did a show that I really liked on FX called Totally Unbiased or Totally Biased, which was just kind of a topic show, kind of a panel show. And it got canceled after a year, but CNN gave him his own show in kind of a sort of Anthony Bourdain slash the guy who did Supersize Me. What's his name?
Anthony Spurlock?
Morgan Spurlock.
Morgan, there it is.
Yeah, kind of in the style of their shows on CNN, where CNN just sends him out to do these mini documentaries in places, and he, you know, covers the subject. And the United Shades of America, he's specifically looking at different racial groups in specific parts of America. I think I talked to you maybe off air about the pilot episode in which he goes to the Deep South to talk to the KKK.
Yeah, that sounds familiar because you were talking about some of it being he's a black fellow.
Yeah.
And it seemed a little dicey to you.
Yeah, the whole thing seemed really, and I mean, I'm sure the show kind of concocted it to make it dramatic, but his first meeting was in the middle of the night on a dirt road, signaling another car with his headlights, the scariest kind of setup you can have imaginable for that kind of thing. And then they walk him to the back to where they're doing a cross burning. Anyway, the reason I'm even bringing this up at the top of the show is the last episode I just watched, and mind you, I have to watch on YouTube after they've done some sort of weird visual alteration to it so that the CNN doesn't take it down. They went to Portland.
Oh.
And you might be somewhat interested in this. They covered the hipster culture and the coffee culture and the artisanal, you know, this and that culture.
Maybe I'd look at it.
I already know that sigh of exasperation, but the greater point of the episode isn't necessarily just, you know, look at these funny white people. it's all about gentrification and how the communities of color that lived in Portland, 20, 30 years ago have been slowly being pushed out in favor of all the people moving in. And how these big corporations are building these big shopping centers and stuff right on top of what used to be community neighborhoods and, you know, forcing people to move out of their homes.
Yeah, they definitely don't believe in parking around here. I'll give you that.
Yeah. Well, everything they got that idea from L.A. You guys are just copying L.A.
I'm not. You're probably right. And that's horrible. It's not a good thing.
No, I know. There are times when I literally think about going somewhere, but it's kind of across town and I know what the parking situation is going to be. And I'm like, should I just Uber?
Yeah, for us, it's a special. Well, we have a pass for the area that my wife works in that was given to her by her work. So we're okay there. So we do little activities there because it's free to exist.
Right.
But certain areas, we're like, oh, saving it for a special occasion so we can pay for parking and then whatever we're going to do after that. Mm-hmm. So,
like today, I went to go to my bank, which is like a few miles from where I live down in Santa Monica, right by the beach and everything. So it's really touristy and it's full of people who are on foot because they're walking to and from the beach to whatever parking garage they decided to park at.
Right.
But it's my closest bank, so I have to go there, and I usually just like pay for a meter for like 15 minutes to get my thing done, and then I drive back home. But today I wanted to get lunch, and there was a Chinese restaurant down there I hadn't been to, and it had okay reviews on Yelp and whatever, but I realized it was like right in the heart of downtown Santa Monica, like where all of that stuff is, right on Wilshire. And I'm like, there's no, like, the only parking garages that were around there were $10 flat fee. So I almost thought about it. I was like, okay, if I paid $10, I couldn't just have lunch and go home. I would feel like a waste. So what if I just hung out in Santa Monica all day?
Yeah, we've done that too.
Just to justify paying for the flat rate.
It's really not that bad here yet, but it is moving towards like places like LA. And the only place that I really live that's comparable would be Chicago. And it was
right
like $30 for downtown parking sometimes.
But there was a couple things in this episode talking about that United Shades episode about Portland. That was, I mean, of course they had to cover the weirder aspects of it just because it's there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place you can pay to cuddle. Like professional cuddlers?
I could be a thing. I sure.
It's like a non-sexual thing, but it's yeah, it's like you pay for like consensual but also like totally platonic cuddling with somebody.
So they're cuddle prostitutes.
Basically.
Oh, okay, got you.
I thought it was extremely perverse, and I was offended by it.
I am a little too. I don't doubt it. Some of that stuff, you just go, okay, sounds right. And then right. You just keep walking down the street.
Today we're going to be reviewing The Neon Demon. And at the end of the episode, we're going to review the documentary An Honest Liar. Let's get into the movie news. We scraped around for a few stories. It wasn't as bustling as it's been in the last few weeks. But I'll start with this one. A story that I guess has been developing for a few years since I posted the wrong one originally. Tom Cruise's Scientology Center movie studio has just been kicked off. It's a $50 million movie studio complex in Hollywood that they bought. And I guess like, not only is it going to be a studio for like possible productions and film and whatever, but they're also like going to start a TV channel that's set to, David Miscavige put out this post. It said something to the effect that it's going to be like the unfiltered truth of Scientology, that it's not going to be through the media bias that slanders them constantly, blah, blah, blah. So the reason I bring this up, there's like the faith-based kind of thing that's going on right now, right? I mean, it's always kind of gone on, but now it's especially going on.
I guess so.
You know, the Christian film industries.
Oh, okay. That's what you're specifically
talking
about.
The Kirk Camerons of the world.
You're talking about within the film community. I was like, yeah.
I mean, well, there's been Christian television networks for a long time.
Yeah, that's what... when you kind of brought this article up, that's what I was thinking. I was like, okay. Lots of faiths have their own little channel, so...
Right, right. So, but this is going to, I think, maybe be a little bit more multifaceted. Maybe sort of like a focus on the family, but for a Scientologist. But, you know, I want to know what, like, I don't know if I'll pay to go see them, but if it ended up on Netflix, I might see a Scientologist film.
Yeah, just to see a kind of an interesting perspective.
Right.
Yeah,
like,
why not?
How do they spin the narrative to fit their kind of worldview, if they're telling traditional narrative drama?
Well, the old article you posted talked about how the John Travolta...
Oh, Battlefield Earth.
Battlefield Earth was basically mostly funded by Scientology and was kind of their...
It was kind of like their...
It was their passions.
It was their story of Genesis, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Their creation myth.
Yeah, yeah.
Because so, it was about like Xenu and all that.
Well, that's right? The name. I was going to say Zorn, but it is Xenu. See, because again, like I was going to go to like my head initially goes to it's like a Christian channel, except you have people dressed in like silver kind of costumes and the
right. And they dress pretty normally. The only thing that's kind of out there is the Sea Org dresses like little sailors.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about them, really. They're just one of those easy jokes, but...
You still haven't seen the documentary Going Clear, which you definitely need to should.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's one of the
that pretty
HBO
much
ones.
Tells you everything I think you need to know, but I'm vaguely curious about what this whole thing's going to be, especially since, according to Alex Gibney's documentary, the church as a whole is kind of shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
And membership is dropping quickly as generations are passing.
Hmm.
And as more information leaks out there. So maybe this is kind of like, the end of the Roman Empire.
My first news story is, why don't we do this? He's been coming up like almost weekly now.
Oh, yeah. John. This week in John Boyega.
Yeah. He's the new It Man, apparently.
He's the new Rock.
Yeah. He's going to be re-collaborating with Joe Cornish, who they did Attack the Block together.
Right.
It was a fun, like, little monster sci-fi Gremlins-esque thing. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out for sure. And it's mm-hmm. kind of what put his name out on the map. And so for them to kind of come back together and do a, I don't know, it's just something new. I guess they're brainstorming it and trying to, and to see what they can create.
Right.
But it's always good when you get, if he has that kind of connection with Joe Cornish, I think it's always good when you kind of pair up and make movies in that way, because you get sort of a working relationship and kind of the nails buttoned down. And if this turned out to be something kind of like, you know, the Cornetto trilogy or something like that with them, that'd be great. Cause Attack the Block was a lot of fun.
It was. And did the article say anything about like what the project could be, or is it just they're sort of talking again?
They are trying to come up with something to do.
Right. So in some way, I mean, he owes everything. John Boyega owes everything to Joe Cornish for giving him the star role in that film, which, you know, got him noticed by Disney to do Star Wars, and now he's going to be in everything. So maybe in a way, Joe Cornish is, hoping to get him in one last movie before he's a huge star and can't afford him.
Right. Well, I think it's smart, too. I mean, I don't know. I could imagine that lifestyle being kind of, especially when you're going like to a big movie like Star Wars. Mm-hmm. It might kind of feel like home, the set there, but I could see it being very transient and you're going from place to place. So it's nice to kind of come home. Per se, to do right. like a film with like some people you already know,
sure.
But sure, again, that seems off topic. I don't really want to talk about movies tonight. So.
That's a great attitude to have.
Yeah,
in our movie podcast. Okay, here's one that's
you've been doing it for 3 or 4 years now. So
sure. Here's one that's a little. I don't know. We'll see what we can get out of this. So apparently. So says Jeff Snyder, who used to work at The Wrap when I was there. Warner Brothers is eyeing Justin Lin to direct an Akira live-action movie. Now, they've been talking about making this Akira movie forever. It's one of those development hell kind of situations where they've been trying to get it off the ground and da-da-da-da. Now we have the Scarlett Johansson version of Ghost in the Shell about to come out.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've already seen some images from that, whatever. Is there a trailer yet for that?
There's not a trailer. There's just been some images and controversy.
Yeah, a lot
there
of
was a thing that they were going to make Scarlett Johansson look more Asian-y. So
well, yeah. So there's that. But I think largely depending on how that movie does, will depend on if the Akira movie actually gets made.
It could, or it could be one of those like weird competitive things where the studios have just got to be like, get this out at the almost the same time.
Right. And then they both end up cannibalizing each other.
Right.
Yeah. But Justin Lin, you know, he's a cool action director. He most famously done, you know, the Fast and the Furious movies. He just did Star Trek Beyond, which is going to come out here later this summer. And I, you know, a lot of people's really been shitting on Star Trek Beyond before it's even come out.
Mm-hmm.
Because in like the trailer, I think it looks fine. I think it looks like what we've got so far. I hold reservations, of course, for actually seeing the movie, but I think he's going to be fine. I mean, it might not be as good as the first one, and I'm in the minority. I actually liked Star Trek Into Darkness, but yeah, I think Justin Lin being attached to Akira, makes me feel a little better about there being a live action Akira, which I don't think we need.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the anime is actually kind of a masterpiece of sorts.
Well, if
for its weirdness that it is.
Well, talking about cannibalization, they're always trying to find a new medium that they can sort of start mining and turn into new. And it feels like since lately that they've just been hungry to find like something that they can do beyond superheroes. Yeah. So, yeah. Akira. Yeah, I mean, I guess now when they first originally made it was just a movie you couldn't, it would be really hard to do in film. But I mean, now that they could, you know, CG it and stuff, but I don't know if it would, I don't know, because for me, the drawings, even though they were drawings, I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, but when the person at the end starts to expand.
Right.
There was a real tactileness to those animations that I would still want to see. So I don't know. It's just a strange idea in general. I know that they've been talking about this forever, probably since Akira did Halfway Decent back in the 80s. But
yeah.
I don't know. I don't have a real opinion on this just because I know that they're going to put out something. So at least this isn't a remake of a movie we just had like 5 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a long time coming, and it's as far as IPs to adapt, it's, you know, it's just good as anything, I guess. But
well, with Justin Lin specifically,
yeah,
that's a hard call because all I really know him from is Fast and the Furious.
Well, you have a better idea, you think, after you see Star Trek Beyond?
I will, and you know, I'm also one of those that I've been okay with the trailer. I don't find a problem with it so far. The newer Star Trek movies have been very popcorny, like big, more explosion tentpole kind of movies in general. So I don't really mind that they move in that direction, especially since they're going to be doing a TV show. I need to see a little bit more like information. There's not enough in my databanks to come.
Right. I mean, the Fast and the Furious movies are good for what they are.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That aesthetic doesn't necessarily apply everywhere else. I think I mentioned this before when talking about Justin Lin for something else. Maybe it was Star Trek forever ago. But I think he's really good at set pieces. Mm-hmm. Right. He's really good at action set pieces. He's really interested in the functionality of an action set piece and how to guide you from, you know, different points in the action and in a way that's comprehensible and sort of fun to follow.
Well, it's part of the storytelling, really, of those big blocks
of those kind of movies. They're essentially they're like musical passages.
Yeah, but exactly. But they're connective tissue. Like you can't just have this random like two people talking in a restaurant, they go outside, they fight, then they come back in the restaurant and sit down. There's actually a reason, and there's like some dramatic influence that leads you through the story. So,
you know, I think My Dinner with Andre needed more big, long fight sequences.
Well, I would agree, but I am kind of, I guess, fetishistic.
Maybe Justin Lin should remake My Dinner with Andre.
With more violence, yes. More action scenes.
And instead of Wally Shawn and whoever played opposite him, it would be The Rock and Vin Diesel.
You see what you're pitching? You're pitching it to be funny. I'm like, yeah, they should do that.
All right. Did you have one other story?
I did. The one that you assigned me because you said I had more to talk about. So Michael Sheen will star and direct The Green River Killer. Michael Sheen, he's you see him here and there and everywhere. Lately, he's been famous for being on The Masters of Sex on Showtime. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it because Showtime is not as accessible as some of the other channels quite yet.
Yeah.
But he's always been good in things he's done. I don't know. I guess he's directed other things that I'm not necessarily that aware of. Are you?
I'm gonna have to look into it, but I don't think so. No, I've seen a lot of the movies he's in, and like you know, the Birth, Movies, Death, which I think was the article I sent you. They used the photo from him from Tron Legacy, which he's like the only really interesting thing in that movie, doing his version of like a David Bowie kind of like meets the MC from Cabaret. And then, so he's really fun in that, and he eats it up. He's even, like, you know, kind of campily fun in the Underworld movies, which might have been the first thing I ever noticed him in. Of course, he was, I think he was nominated for Frost Nixon. No, The Queen he was in. And then my favorite performance of his, I think, was playing the douchey, blowhard, whatever you want to call him, like, friend of a friend. In Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris.
Oh, right. The pedantic one.
Yeah.
He was a lot of, most of the people in that were pretty fun. But he was one of the ones that stood out, and he had one of those harder roles because he had to play the douchebag. And a lot of times when you play the douchebag, you come off as one.
Right.
But if you did your job well, you're a good actor. So he is a good actor, but I guess where the line kind of comes in, because while I'm a big fan of like, a big fan, that sounds weird to say it that way. While I'm, I have a strange obsession with studying like serial killers and weird crimes and stuff like that. I this one specifically, like when you make a film of these things, there's two things. Is either you're making something that has some kind of like zeitgeisty kind of like meaning, or you're making just some trash because it sounds exciting because it's people that kill people.
Right. It's salacious or whatever.
And if I'm being honest, the Green River Killer, while there are the more interesting things about him he's not very intelligent. For a serial killer, he was very, you know, he's kind of a very simple guy. Went to Nam, came back and killed prostitutes.
Right.
As you know, so I don't know what the angle is completely on the story. So that's a little, if they're going from some of the other, like there was the Green River Killer, like Dark Horse comic, that came out a couple years back. That was pretty good, but that focused more through the detective story and him chasing him down and the changes in technology over the years and stuff like that.
So. I mean, I'm willing to bet that's the take. I don't think he's going to make like a straightforward kind of serial killer, like horror film out of it. Like
straight to DVD kind of.
Yeah, like the Dahmer movie or like the Ed Gein movie or whatever. I think it's going to be a lot closer to like, I mean, I guess sort of in the vein of a Seven or a Silence of the Lambs or something a little classier, maybe even.
Well, those are horror thrillers, basically.
Right. Yeah. But you know what I mean? Where it's going to be more procedural, and it's probably, I doubt the Green River Killer himself will be the main character, because it's actually really difficult to make a complete sociopath your main character.
Right.
Unless you're doing the movie about, you know, a broken down mind, like in an American Psycho or something like that. Like,
well, I was thinking also, Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Portrait of a Serial Killer, kind of Taxi Driver. Yeah, I mean, it can be done, but it's hard because it's difficult to find a way in emotionally for those characters.
Yeah, it's an easy way to be. There's a great word for this that I can't think of right now. It's exploitative, but that's not the word.
Right.
It can kind of just come almost across kind of tactless and tacky.
Right.
And specifically, I just don't think that the with this specific serial killer, I don't know what the story is really. It was a large number and it went unnoticed for a long time. One of the more interesting things about cases is he was in certain of his killings, he like tampered with the evidence to throw off the police at the time. But I mean, other than that, it took a long time to catch him, but that was more because he's kind of a really simple and kind of quiet mannered man.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, the ones who have the largest body counts are, that's usually the case. They're not the people in society you would notice.
Well, yeah, the people who, because I mean, the people who do bigger crimes in front of everybody to get the attention are going to get caught more often. If you're killing co-eds at a college, they come from families.
Right.
Whereas prostitutes, in one of the terms that they use for prostitutes, runaways, and immigrants is the lesser dead, because people just don't tend to give as much shit when they get killed.
Right. Prostitutes and homeless people and then people like that.
Right. And so by targeting these victims specifically, mm-hmm. They're like, well, she was out doing that, so it makes it easier. So, I mean, it depends. There are angles to go at it. I just don't know. Specifically, I just don't know how. It could be interesting. Like I said, I really enjoyed the comic a couple years out called The Green River Killer. But it focused a lot on the detectives and their side of the story as opposed to the actual killer.
Okay, cool. Well, let's get into the reviews. And we're gonna start here with the main review of the week, which is Nicholas Winding Refn's The Neon Demon. I think we covered this a little bit in our news when we saw this developing. And Nicholas Winding Refn, of course, being the director, was Dutch in origin, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think he's like a second.
The filmer himself, yes. This movie, it's like all over the place.
No, this movie is, I think, American financed or possibly co-financed. There's a lot of production companies involved. Like, you know, the beginning of a movie when they show you.
It's one of those new independent movies that has like 12, like
12 different, yeah, people involved in, you know, somebody's rich dentist and whatever.
Right.
Well, the movie's set in America. But Nicholas Winding Refn, of course, he directed Drive, which we both liked a lot, with Ryan Gosling. And he also directed Only God Forgives, which we were not as into, with Ryan Gosling.
Though I defended.
You defended a little bit more than I do.
Yeah.
For what it is, I suppose. And of course, you know, before that, the Pusher trilogy and in his homeland, as well as Valhalla Rising and
Bronson.
Bronson, which was sort of what put Tom Hardy on the map. So he's a very stylish, very interesting European director who's crossed the seas and to some amount of success here, at least American curiosity. I don't know if it's translated into full success yet.
Very visually driven fellow.
Very, 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 very visually driven. And he, you know, he kind of straddles the line, I think, between the European art house mode of emotionally driven kind of dreamscapes and that don't necessarily have to be all that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And then American genre boilerplate stuff. Like, Drive is a full-on kind of L.A. noir movie, but done in a European style.
Right.
And this movie is sort of a horror film of sorts, or at least his take on a horror film. And it focuses on Elle Fanning, who plays a would-be model named Jessie, who's moved into L.A. to reach for the stars and make her dreams come true. She's sleeping in a seedy hotel in Pasadena that's owned by Keanu Reeves.
Not literally by Keanu Reeves, by his character.
I mean, we never hear his name, so it could be Keanu Reeves.
That you're right there. You're right there. It could just be him on his off day.
Keanu Reeves is playing himself as a CD hotel owner in Pasadena. We catch it kind of in a strange place in her story, because she's met a young photographer who's kind of also looking to make his dreams come true by doing some, you know, some portraits and some concept art, whatever you want to call it, of Elle Fanning, so that she has a little bit of a portfolio to kind of move forward. Christina Hendricks works for some very big modeling agency and says, "You're it, kid. I'm gonna make you a star." And along the way, she meets Jenna Malone, who's a makeup artist, and a few other models, played by Bella Heathcote and Abby Lee. And, you know, egos clash. They're from L.A. They've been here. They've done it. They've, you know, they've lost their soul in the industry. You know, they don't really have a lot of patience for her, like, bright-eyed 16-year-old innocence. And all of this sounds very traditional. I mean, if you hear me describing this story, this essentially sounds like the plot of, like, every, like, you know, the industry corrupts story you've ever heard. And in a way, it is every industry corrupt story you've ever seen. I mean, I texted a friend who wanted to know how I thought about the movie because we almost saw it together and ended up not. And I, you know, I said, I'm not 100% sure how I feel about it, but I think I described it as, it's like Mario Bava's, Blood and Black Lace meets Showgirls in slow motion.
That's not a bad description.
And, you know,
I would say the acting's still better than Showgirls, but go on.
Off and on.
Yeah.
I mean, the acting, it's very dreamlike. The whole movie is very dreamlike, and not necessarily in like a Lynchy way, but a little bit more like a giallo way. And in some places it kind of feels like a fairy tale kind of come to life or kind of being retold in a modern way. In a maybe kind of Suspiria-ish way. Like there's kind of a Grimm's kind of tale kind of thing going on here. And then, of course, a lot of it is very heavily aestheticized. I mean, it's beautifully shot. I mean, you know, the camera is just, you know, alive with activity of just these incredibly, active, or not active, actually, a lot of it's very, like, slow-moving tableaus, but, you know, very, very, kind of, deliberately lit and deliberately shot kind of framing and that kind of stuff in a way that it's almost more interested in how it looks than maybe necessarily the story stuff all the time. Yeah, I'm a little fresh off of it and I'm still kind of soaking it in. I don't even know how I'm going to review the damn thing once I get down to actually putting pen on paper, as it were. But what did you think of Neon Demon?
I had kind of a similar reaction, and it's been a couple days now for me getting off of it, but, I'm going to get heady a little bit with it.
Oh, please.
I think it's a lot about the male gaze, the movie.
Okay.
And I think purposefully. I don't know if it always executes it very well, but I think that is part of its intention. From that first shot, you have this kind of zooming pan from her, and then you get back and you get these intense stares from this photographer. And it's very much, it becomes from, you're looking at her through this person's eyes.
Right.
And I don't think it's a comment back on him. I think it's what the movie is about because you have several scenes like this.
Right.
And it's kind of talking about, the different aspects of that. Now, does it all pay off? I'm not exactly sure. There is kind of a dreamlike quality. For certain people, I could see this being like the worst movie they'd ever seen, because this definitely doesn't have Quentin Tarantino poppy dialogue, and the dialogue isn't even really, they don't give a shit about it.
It's not front and center, no.
It's not front and center, and it's also not, like, if you're watching for the dialogue and listening to their interchanges and being like, oh, wow, that's interesting. Well, if you think it's interesting, you're dull and you're not that
bright. You've never heard humans talk. Yeah.
Yeah. Then there are only a few ones that are very key. There is the scene with Christina Hendricks, like you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things talking about age, and the age thing is kind of interesting just because, again, going back to that male gaze, and you have this very young 16-year-old main character, but everybody is sexualizing her and producing, saying this is the what you should look like.
Right. Sorry, their kind of understanding of youthful beauty is very different from hers.
Right.
At least up to a point. And then the movie kind of like shifts a little bit as far as how we're supposed to feel about her understanding of everything. Like she goes from like doe-eyed and naive to at one point she seems like she's maybe in her own autonomy and is sort of like maybe like transitioning into becoming the star she thinks she should be. And then that autonomy kind of slips away, and for me that's a little bit of a narrative problem. But what else were you gonna say?
So this movie is kind of a mixed bag. I for like a hardcore horror fan, I don't know if this is going to give you what you're looking for. What I would use this movie for, though, is kind of a debate. I've often heard It Follows referred to as art house horror.
Sure.
And I'd very much disagree with that kind of stance. This is more of an art house horror, if we're talking about this.
Okay.
Like, I mean, seriously, because it does hit some genre marks, too. It has some shock moments towards the end.
Right. There's some bloodletting.
And there's some stuff that made me uncomfortable and squirm in my seat in a very, like, kind of fun, like, horror way.
It goes there.
Yeah, it does.
It takes a while to get there, but it goes there.
And I don't know if some of it actually because of there when you're talking about this is maybe something we'll kind of like ping pong off of each other here a little bit.
Sure.
But the slow pace at first I was like, this does have extremely slow pacing. And I find myself kind of talking to myself during the movie and not out loud. So we're okay. but at one point I asked myself when I was watching it, I was like, well, I was like, man, this is slow pacing. Or is this my problem? Because we see so many, like Warcraft that has something going on every 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is it just hard for us to process? Because we just see so many movies that are so fastly paced and have so much things shoved into them that this very deconstructed minimalistic plot, you have a hard time like just kind of focusing on it and letting it breathe. Right. But again, I think it is kind of an exercise in visuals and some ideas. I don't know how it comes together completely as a narrative or as a film completely.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it does at least make you think about how we receive the idea of beauty and how we think about beauty. I don't know if it's necessarily that deep or provocative of an idea because it's things that I could think in my head without seeing a movie. But again, just for on the visual stance alone, I thought that it was pretty. It was a beautiful kind of experience in that sense.
Right.
And I did think of Giallo, for sure, to a certain degree. And then also, I was trying to think of another. It reminded me of another movie, and I couldn't quite place my finger on it. But I don't know. It left me leaving like I didn't have like necessarily thoughts like, oh, yes, this is great. Or, oh, yes, this is bad. When I left the theater, I was literally like, how do I feel about that?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm thinking about it and I'm feeling it and I'm kind of, I experienced it. So was that the point?
I mean, definitely that's the point of most films, but especially I think a Nick Refn film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, we can see through his work, you know, going from the Pusher trilogy all the way up, he's becoming less interested in story as he goes. And he's more interested now in kind of feeling his way through movies. And so a lot of times if a scene doesn't even necessarily have to make sense, quote unquote, or like have to fit in with the trajectory of the narrative, if you kind of get the idea that he just loves the scenery of it. He just loves the soaking in the mise-en-scene and sort of just exploring it and let it, you know, kind of, you know, bathing in the moviness sometimes. And he's a little bit of a fetishistic director in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say that that's style over substance. And sometimes I think it is. I think in the case with Only God Forgives, it definitely was. In this movie, yes. But also I think style kind of is substance in this movie. Because you could complain that this is all just a lot of surface, but the entire narrative is about surfaces.
That's true. Well, and there are scenes that I do really feel like really like hit, and that I had to like kind of process and think about the one with Christina Hendricks,
mm-hmm.
the one with the like big time photographer guy, like when they were sitting in the diner.
Yeah, that was a good scene.
Specific scenes that are a little bit more, they have a little bit more weight to them.
Mm-hmm.
I go back and forth about how I feel. And I do agree. For me, the only thing is I feel like thematically there should at least be a flow. And sometimes it just didn't feel like it felt like there was flashing lights and not much
literally
else to it. Yeah. literally flashing lights. But it did look gorgeous. So,
yeah, I mean, I recommend seeing it in theaters just for that reason alone, as just to see this thing, just to behold the thing, even if you're not into it as a story or you're not into horror, you're not into these actors, whatever it might be. I think just to kind of see like the power of visual cinema as just an act of putting things in the frame and lighting them a certain way. I think this movie is sort of a masterwork of that. And aesthetically, I'm in love with the movie. I love kind of this, you know, early 90s kind of Vogue magazine vibe that it's going for a lot of the times. I love kind of the the dreamy sort of Tangerine Dream soundtrack in the background. That kind of, you know, intensifies as scenes become more surreal. I actually like the fact that the acting's kind of blah, and that the dialogue is kind of blah, because it reminded me of like those kind of like horror films from the 70s and 80s, or especially like the Italian ones that were kind of weirdly dubbed over.
Mine wasn't necessarily a criticism. I'm just saying there are certain people and their arguments against
it. Yeah, people will, and maybe even rightfully will complain about that.
Yeah, but I'm just saying this isn't Quentin Tarantino.
No.
This isn't, that's not the type of filmmaking this is. And so if you're looking at it through that film of that perspective, you're not going to understand or like this film. So if you don't like films that are more image driven,
right,
or mood, visually driven and mood driven, you won't like this film. This to me, it kind of almost, I would liken it to like Under the Skin, but not, maybe not as well.
It's not as lean. Under the Skin has a single kind of idea or a single kind of point of view. And all of the scenes, as weird as they get, all kind of point back to that. Whereas I said with Nicholas Winding Refn, he kind of feels his way through scenes, and he'll take digressions for the sake thereof, in a way that kind of hinders plot a lot of the time. And I feel like this movie, really honestly, I think this movie just could be a tighter edit. I think that some of the long kind of tableaus and slow moving camera stuff and sort of soaking in the scenery, there could be less of that. And it would be a better movie. I think you could cut out 20 minutes of some scenes that don't really do much. And just to get, pull the plot points a little closer together.
Mm-hmm.
Just so that you can kind of get to where I feel like the movie is headed anyway. Because I feel like once we get to that third act, which by that point, I think it does pay off. And it actually kind of becomes insanely twisted. But also kind of powerful in a cinematic way, in a horror sort of way.
Yeah.
And also, you know, going back to the themes and all that stuff, I think it all sort of pays off. But it kind of took so long to get there that I felt like, I was like, oh, okay, so this was what it was getting at. Because a lot of these side characters we only brush up against for a few times in the movie, and I didn't know that they would become as big of players.
Well, the tension kind of releases in strange places, and so...
Yeah.
So you do, I mean... Because I mean, you feel the threat from a lot of the characters early on, and especially the characters that you later see. Jenna Malone's turn, that was really heavy and impactful to me. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a turn that I felt and saw the whole time. And it was early on. It was, you know, there were the big cats in the background. There was all that kind of stuff that was going on. So I found it interesting. It also, I think, could be tightened maybe character-wise. Some of the characters that are in there from the start, they kind of disappear and they just don't really lead anywhere. So you could get a tighter, just by eliminating some of those characters that just kind of don't do as much.
Mm.
Like, I think you could have just, the photographer from the first scene, I think you could have got rid of him easily and had other characters do the same interactions that he was having with her. And it could have pulled the plot and the ideas tighter. But at the same time, it's just sort of one of those things that it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
Because this film, especially, it's kind of about the experience and some of those flashing scenes, and it puts you in the moment.
Uh-huh.
And it tries to, it's somewhere between like putting you in the scene naturalistically, but then being a surrealistic environment. So it's...
Right. There's a lot of what we're asking for, a lot of the edits that we're suggesting leads to a more conventional movie. And that's not necessarily the strength of whatever it is that we ended up getting.
Mm-hmm.
It might be, for flaws and all, better the way it is than to be conventional.
Yeah.
Because then it really is just Showgirls, or it really is just kind of another Black Swan or something like that.
Well, I know that he's, well, maybe you could bounce this off, because in an interview with him, he said that something about, what was the films that he's, I can't remember the horror film, but the other film, he said Valley of the Dolls was a huge influence on this movie.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I mean, okay, so here's the other thing, right? Okay. As you know, we're getting kind of heady, and we went that direction a lot faster than I thought we would.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideas are maybe there, and they're being played with, and it's gorgeous to look at. It's beautifully shot. I think he knows the movie he's making, or at least he's intuitive about the movie he's making. Maybe he doesn't necessarily have a handle on the narrative. But with all of that said, I still kind of had a hard time not putting a quotation marks around everything. The movie, maybe in a good way, I'm not sure yet, is pretty campy. I actually don't even take that as an insult. This will be a midnight movie for gay audiences in the future. I 100% guarantee this will be shown with Valley of the Dolls and Showgirls and Liquid Sky and The Apple and all of those kind of movies that play to that audience really well. I guarantee at the end of the year, this is going to be pretty high on John Waters' favorite movies list. Because it is one of those kind of movies. And I think it knows that. I didn't know that he dropped Valley of the Dolls, but the fact that that was one of his going references, well, there you fucking go. So it is, in a way, it's almost like he's taking the gay camp classic narrative drama that, like, you know, the young ingenue comes and wants to displace, you know, the All About Eve narrative. And is kind of perversing it into becoming an Italian horror film on acid. Yeah, I think I'm actually liking this movie the more I'm talking about it.
I can tell. The one thing that I kind of wondered, because when he was first kind of putting it together, yes, he kind of feels his way through the film, and you can feel that, and it's not a bad thing about the film.
No, it's just the way that's his, the way he sees film. That's just that's his language.
And it is interesting that Ella Fanning, who plays the lead, like, young girl, was actually 16. That's sort of interesting. And it's an interesting part of the thematics. But I couldn't help but think, because in his first iteration of this, he was getting Carey Mulligan to do it.
Oh, that would have been interesting. But I don't think that would have worked as well, because I mean, if you're just talking about, like, the physicality, Elle Fanning fits that long, tall L.A. model look. Like, she's real thin and cut and kind of angular, whereas Carey Mulligan is a little softer. And I don't mean that like she's fat or chubby or whatever. I just mean, in general, her build is not really a model's build.
Two white guys talking about women. Specifically, I was more talking about the maturity to take on the part and kind of like how would that have changed the narrative, but maybe this would have been a whole other movie if that. And so it is a weird what if, but at the same time, I can't help but think of her interactions with some of these characters versus Ella Fanning, and Ella Fanning did a fine job.
Yeah. She's playing it, very interior. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's an actress I think that what a lot of people like about her, and maybe to some extent Carey Mulligan as well, but I think even more so with Elle Fanning, and she's very vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And there you really get a sense that you're getting kind of a raw expression from her, even as she's in like stuff like Super 8 or whatever, these kind of big movies, but as well as, like, you know, the Somewhere, the Sofia Coppola movie, she's just effortlessly putting it all out there without having to do very much at all. And the camera kind of finds that vulnerability in her eyes and her expressions. And she's actually doing a lot of good work in this movie. The movie is so overwhelmingly aestheticized that her performance might get buried under that. But I think it still peeks through.
Yeah. There is that debate. Do we want this more like a mainstream versus not? That what I would say to like a viewing audience, if you are interested in more of kind of experimental looking film or art films and stuff like that, then you would maybe enjoy this more. But if you are kind of more like, oh, this isn't Independence Day 5, fuck that, then you're not going to like this film. And I'm not saying that to be belittling or mean. I'm saying that literally because this is not a conventional film. And I think it would only play to people who have...
Who are into that.
Who are into that and willing to go to the theater and experience something and be okay to sometimes, not feel like that there's a story or whatever happening.
Right. Or if you're a super huge fan of Valley of the Dolls and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls and Showgirls and Liquid Sky and all of those other camp classics, and you want to watch this movie strictly only putting it in quotation marks, you can watch it that way.
No, you could totally watch this with a bunch of people and make the fun of it the whole time.
And I think the movie is sort of built to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe almost even cynically, but
I don't know. It's sort of a weird mix.
Yeah.
The other weird thought I had, and maybe you'll just tell me I'm crazy after this, or maybe you'll be like, oh, maybe you're going. I also wondered too if it had something, because there's a lot of things to do with age, in the film. Because I also thought about kind of like the young photographer versus the older photographer versus Ella Fanning versus some of these older models versus Jenna Malone versus like Christina Hendricks, and there's all this kind of age dynamics of different parts of the industry,
right?
And their different takes on the world, and Keanu Reeves for that matter too.
And the fact that they got Keanu Reeves, I mean, that's definitely a piece of stunt casting.
I thought he was pretty good in this. Like, I might be weird. I thought he was kind of intimidating at times. And then also I thought he was really seedy and gross.
Well, definitely is seedy and gross. I don't know. I didn't 100% know what to do with his performance. It was fine for what it was.
I think that there's some interesting back and forth with ideas. There's some interesting visuals. There's interesting a lot of stuff, but it just depends on your take on film. I enjoyed it in the fact that it was an interesting experience at the theater.
Yeah,
that's kind of what I came to in the last couple days. But
definitely, I think, you know, by the time the movie ended and I kind of better feel, there was a lot of times in the movie where I was like, OK, where are you going, movie? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I feel like you're drifting off into aesthetic land, floating out in the sea. But once I knew like what the actual story was and I could piece it together like ABC, mm-hmm. and I saw what it was doing, and then, you know, I was able to see like maybe how it could have done those things stronger, but I was also able to see like, oh, okay, it pays off. And I think that the, those final sequences are so powerful and so shocking.
I actually thought the last, the kind of the send you off kind of,
yeah,
shocking images, that actually didn't do as much for me. I was way more creeped out by Jenna Malone.
Well, Jenna Malone, I mean, yeah, she took the
cake.
She definitely eating it up here, literally and figuratively.
besides her scenes in the morgue, all that stuff really was like, whoa. And so even though that these last scenes are like more visceral of the film, and it is a very traditional kind of horror note. But again, all of that stuff plays back into the themes.
Right.
You've got the eye and you've beauty passing on kind of things and the cannibalization.
Right.
It makes sense. But I, as like a horror fan, and that's what I really think it comes down to, is I was like, you could have made that bigger and it would have worked better. But there's small criticisms. But in general, I think it's, this is definitely art house horror. If somebody could refer to this as art house horror, I would say yes. It follows some of those. I kind of squint my eyes a little bit. I'm like, I don't think so.
I mean, you could.
I love It Follows.
Right. You could call this art house horror. I think you could also call this kind of enjoyable trash cinema as well. And you know,
it's kind of both.
It's kind of both. Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing.
No.
That's what he kind of makes anyways.
Right, exactly. And if he does have sort of a genetic link to Tarantino, it's in elevating trash.
True.
But okay, let's go ahead and move on to the Netflix review, which you assigned me last week, the documentary An Honest Liar. Why don't you go ahead and tell me what that's about?
Honest Liar is a documentary about the amazing Randy. Maybe you've heard of him. I actually had. It kind of goes through his life and his kind of about being a magician, but telling you right up front, he's a con man and a charlatan. Besides being an escape artist and this magician afterwards, one of the things he really did was debunk like faith healers and spiritualists and parapsychologists and a lot of things to show this is the truth and this is what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
He was very good at it. And, you know, he kind of got his arch nemesis in a fairly famous psychic of the 1970s and 80s.
Yeah.
Uri, I think it is. But it also, it kind of goes through and it kind of shows you, it kind of peels back the layers little bit by little bit. So you kind of get this kind of dual narrative where it's about him and debunking, and there's kind of almost like this back and forth kind of thriller-esque kind of elements of it. And then we cut back to his personal life, and there's a plot twist. It kind of talks about honesty and the documentary and being and what it means to be a charlatan, but it also kind of talks about like why we have these things and why people pay so much money to see, you know, something like a magic deck that everybody knows is fake.
Right.
And so it kind of goes on about those things and what they mean to people. And it also kind of talks about, I forgot the Pop Hill. What was the Faith Healer's name?
Popoff, I think.
Yeah.
Famous like televangelist of the 80s, it looks like, who was one of those, you know, through the power of Jesus, you can walk kind of tent revivalist types.
Hit you in the head and
it gets rid of
your cancer.
Benny Hill kind of became really popular for doing the same thing in the 90s. And there's been a lot to secede him. So it's not a thing that's by any means not still out there.
Yeah, it also kind of even says it's almost basically become seed churches. So if you watch John Oliver, that just adds on to that whole humor, to me at least it did. But it is an I mean, the Amazing Randy, he's an interesting person, and to see kind of his perspective and what he's done, and then kind of the payoff to see his, again, I feel like to kind of talk about this movie, you almost have to kind of like, I'm glad I went into it not knowing a lot. I don't know, did you know where this was going?
No, I didn't. You know, I didn't know him by name. But it's one of those documentaries. He's a terrific documentary subject for this exact reason. He's just lived such a crazy life, and he's done so much, and he's done, you know, big things, and has been sort of, you know, a part of big things. You know, even stuff outside of the world of, you know, the story that the movie's telling, but stuff like he was the prop guy at Alice Cooper concerts and taught him how to make it look convincing when he cut off his own head on stage.
That was pretty awesome. Yeah.
Yeah,
and lots of Johnny Carson.
Lots of Johnny Carson. But he comes from like the world of like old sort of carnival tent freak show kind of stuff too. So like he's really like lived the gamut of popular culture, and seen it change. So, you know, one of the most interesting things is when he's trying to debunk this Russian charlatan who claims to, you know, be able to bend spoons with his mind and keys and whatever else. And he goes on to the Today Show or whatever it might be, Johnny Carson and things, to show how to do these tricks. And he says, yeah, they used to put this on the back of cereal boxes. Like, I think that kind of makes him a really interesting subject, is because he has that kind of overwhelming perspective.
Well, he's also very, like, very persistent in how he feels about these things, and has really pursued.
He's on a crusade.
Yeah, is a crusader. That is a good way to say that.
For skepticism.
Yeah.
And really, before that was a popular thing, you know, we look at, like, you know, sometimes I have just, like, I get too depressed. As a skeptic or whatever you want to call it, I get really depressed about how easily swayed and easily convinced people are of ridiculous and stupid things. But then you look at like this video footage of people from the 60s and 70s, and how like even the science community were kind of duped by these parapsychologists or whatever, or parapsychics. And then you realize how far we've actually come in just a short amount of time as far as making science more scientific.
Well, kind of to talk about this, because there is kind of a payoff towards the end, right?
Well, some might think so. I actually have issues with the B plot in this movie.
Okay.
I don't think it's all that necessary for the movie. I get what the story's going for, and it's a reveal, so I'm not going to give it away. But I get like the conclusions or the parallels they're trying to draw between him and his life with this partner of his that he's lived with forever. And
see, I think
the life they've built around each other. And, you know, some of these documentaries, I like, what was the H.R. Giger one we saw? Giger's World or something like that. Yeah, and we saw a little bit. It kind of had a similar kind of back and forth between, like, how he's living his old man life and, like, the world he came from and his success and everything.
Well, this one, I think, is a little... This one's a little tighter and a little bit better. And
well, this one definitely has more of kind of a, like, you can tell, like,
a narrative trajectory.
Right. Yeah. You can tell, like, when the writers were sifting through the footage and they had these two stories and they cracked it and they figured out how to tell this story the way they wanted to.
Okay. The B line, though, I'm going to say that's a red herring. It's really the C line that is kind of the actual, like, crux of the story, though.
Okay.
Because that C line from the very get go, he's you know, the line is anybody can be duped.
Right.
It doesn't matter how smart, educated, how much any of those things, you can be fooled. And so that's what I think it's inevitably about. And right. It's interesting when it is interesting to see the role reversed and to see his honest emotional reaction to things that were happening in his life.
I don't think it's like tears down the movie by any means. I just think that like,
oh no. I think it's part of the movie, but it's also part of the message. And it's part of the overall what was happening.
Yeah. It's integrated in such a way that it's definitely pulling you towards a theme. It's not clunky. Well, it is. I think it is a little clunky, but it's not.
It is a little.
I there's sometimes when I'm following the thread of like his life and his mission and everything like that, and then we go back to the future and he's dealing with these other problems, and I'm like, I feel like the movie's on a tangent, even if it comes to that point where everything's supposed to. There's a ta-da moment in this movie, a prestige, if you will, that I don't think really pays off as much as the movie thinks it does.
Mm-hmm.
Like it kind of comes to this moment where you're supposed to be like, see, even this, and he's, you know, a hypocrite and whatever. And I was like, I guess I think you're.
I don't think it was. I don't think it was to conflate or to show him in a negative light. It's just to show that his reasoning is true. I don't think it still is necessarily edited because it seems like the A story mm-hmm. is like 85% of the movie. The B yeah. story is like 10%, and then this like weird payoff is like 5%, and you don't really, and so it does kind of pay off in kind of a weird, but it's like one of those thrillers you watch and you're kind of dissatisfied with the ending because the movie is like kind of tricking you, but not in a way that you're a part of it. It's just like, yeah. You're like, you're being an asshole. I'm going to say, I don't think that it was meant to be like, oh, he's a hypocrite, or say how like negative it was, because that wasn't my take on it.
Like, I mean, I get what the movie's trying to do. It's trying to pull off a magic trick. And there's something about the structure that is a little too clever, I think, for its own good. And I think, actually, they had enough good stuff with his life story. And you could even fit in the modern stuff and this, you know, this strange case that's going on in his life. I think you could do it in a way that was a little less gotcha, which I felt was a little hokey.
It did, and like I said, it's partially, I think, in the pacing and plotting of it, and again, I think with editing works, it could have been like this. I was very much engaged in the story and very much liked it, and so, this is again, it's like one of those thrillers that you're into, and then by the end, when it drops the third act reveal, you're kind of like, okay. And so this to me, I mean, it did, I will say that it did kind of remind me of Earl Morris, but it's like Earl Morris light, not as well done as his films. And so in that way, it was a little frustrating, but it's not bad by any means.
No, I actually think it's pretty good. I would say despite my complaints with the structure, and how it balances its A plot and B plot. I think that the stuff here, the historical aspect of it, you know, just being able to see this footage and put together in a way, and you know, all the other documentary subjects who come in and talk about him, whether it be the other magicians he's worked with in the past, or people like Alice Cooper, or people like Penn and Teller, who kind of, you know, definitely carried on his crusade. or Bill Nye, or, you know, all of these kind of people. I think all of that stuff is really good, and I think totally makes it worth watching. I had a lot of fun watching this documentary. Even when it did stuff that kind of annoyed me, I still was glad I got what I got out of it.
Agreed. Agreed. Again, like I think we had a very similar experience, and I think that that's what kind of take away from it at that end point. I guess what frustrated about me is I was in it enough that I felt like, oh, you could pay this off, but then it kind of didn't.
Yeah.
And so I guess this is one of those endings that's frustrating but doesn't ruin the film.
Uh-huh.
So I in general, I would recommend it to people if you're interested in debunking faith healers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, if you're interested in sort of like modern skepticism, or you're into even if you're just into like just obscure sort of pop culture stuff, I think there's a lot of that here. And it's one of those kind of, you know, takes a peek at a world that isn't normally, you know, discussed at length. And well, especially the world of kind of performance magic and stuff, which is usually just kind of sloughed off as parlor tricks and cheap and Vegas and whatever. You know, here's somebody who's actually like used all of that knowledge in a way that's, you know, positive.
Yeah. And also, I mean, beyond that, they kind of don't like to show behind the curtains for a lot of that stuff, too. So you kind of get to see it from. And also, I mean, he's just, again, like you said earlier, he's just one of those fun characters.
Yeah, he's still very lucid, but despite the fact that he's a million years old, he can still talk to the camera very well. He's very articulate. He remembers everything like it was yesterday. You don't get the idea that they're exploiting this poor old man. Like, I mean, well, there's one point where they definitely are, and I kind of wonder, like, what the, like, there's a point where he's like, you're not going to use this. Or I'm not in, and it's like, well, they did, so I guess you guys ironed that out, or you were really surprised at the premiere.
In the credits, they even say he said yes to
everything that was shown.
To everything that's been shown. So.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't catch that. Oh, there you go. So they're not exploiting a poor old man.
there you go, everybody. It's okay. I understood what they're going for. It just didn't seem like it was executed. They just didn't stick the landing.
Right.
I'd be curious to see what else. I would like to see some more of their like documentaries and what they do in the future.
Yeah. Tyler Meesom and Justin Weinstein were the ones who did that. Okay. So next week,
what you assigning me?
We're going to watch the direct-to-Netflix Adam Sandler comedy The Do-Over, which just barely was put on the streaming list. And
see, I feel very strange about this because, like, are you just having, like, a lapse? Or what's happening here? Because usually I'm the one that makes you takes this weird risk and watches a movie that is questionable of origins.
Right. It's been a long time since I've seen an actual Adam Sandler movie, and there's not a lot of good reason to see this one. I'm curious to know how the Happy Madison thing runs under the Netflix factory.
Well, and he, even though I think with maybe there's some reasoning behind it, he's also somebody that the internet hates now. So,
yes. And he's become popular to kind of hate on, and reasonably so. But, you know, we'll talk about it when we talk about it next week. So we're going to watch The Do-Over. And we'll see how we feel about that. And it might be a movie that other people have actually seen, because despite the terrible reviews, even The Do-Over and The Ridiculous Six have done pretty well on Netflix in, you know, those numbers that they don't release to anybody.
Well, they have their own whatever, their own metrics. And I know that they're not as it's a brave new world of content.
Right.
So.
If anybody has anything to say about anything that we watched or talked about today, whether it be An Honest Liar, The Do-Over next week, or The Neon Demon, or anything you might want to, any questions you might want to pose us, you can do so at our email at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast. And be sure to subscribe to us or listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, Zune, and the Windows Podcast Network. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can see some reviews and content I provided for the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Our friend Brad Decker, who's also been on the show before, go check out his entertainment comic/film online outlet, panelandframe.com. And we have friends out there who also do podcasts, and you should be listening to Leland's comedy podcast, dampercast.com, Rod and Denise over at their music request podcast at The Listening Party, and friend of the show, Patrick from Detroit, who does two different podcasts, Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. And I haven't actually put them on the list, but I might as well. You should also check out Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast, because they're friends with a lot of our friends, and I've been on their show, and they're pretty good guys. That's it. That's the show.
And we're done.
Bye.
Bye.